From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, some fashion tips from model-turned-talk show host Pat Stevens, and some talk about comedy from Stevens' creator, Nora Dunn. Dunn is a former cast member of Saturday Night Live. In her new book, she's revived several of the characters she created for the show. Also today, we talk with syndicated political cartoonist Jeff Danziger. He's written a novel based on his tour of duty in Vietnam. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new tribute to Ornette Coleman. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie Rambling Rose. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The United Nations has announced that the standoff has ended between Iraqi authorities and UN weapons inspectors in Baghdad. David Kay, the American who leads the team, told Cable News Network that the two sides have reached an agreement on an inventory of documents that the inspectors have seized. Kay said that his team retains full control of all the documents and videotapes it has removed from an Iraqi research site. Iraqi authorities have claimed that the documents include sensitive personnel records that could compromise Iraqi scientists. Rioting has again broken out in the center of the Romanian capital, Bucharest, between thousands of miners along with their supporters and security forces. The demonstrators threw gasoline bombs at guards around the presidential palace. The demonstrators are protesting the government's austerity measures. Malcolm Brabant filed this report from Bucharest for the BBC.
Fighting began at lunchtime, just as the authorities hoped the miners were about to give up their protest and return to the coal fields. The miners' leader, Miron Cosma, spent the morning with President Iliescu and emerged declaring that all of their grievances had been settled. But the miners decided that they'd been double-crossed and ignored the call to return home. Several thousand civilians joined in the fight around the president's palace, taking cover behind the high walls to lob petrol bombs at the defending soldiers. More clashes are likely, as the Prime Minister, Petru Roman, has said he will not leave office until the situation has calmed down. And President Iliescu has refused to bow to the demonstrators, saying that his resignation is out of the question.
Malcolm Brabant reporting for the BBC. Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir says there can be no role in the peace process for two leading Palestinian activists who've repeatedly met with Secretary of State James Baker during his Middle East peace missions. Patricia Golan reports from Jerusalem that the Prime Minister was responding to reports that Faisal al-Husseini and Hanan Ashrawi had traveled to Algiers to brief PLO officials on the peace process.
The PLO-sponsored conference in Algiers was convened to decide on Palestinian participation in Middle East peace talks. There have been reports that Husseini and Ashrawi secretly briefed PLO officials in Algiers, strongly denied by the two. The controversy and mystery stems from an Israeli law forbidding contacts with members of terror groups. Israel defines the PLO as a terrorist organization, and Israeli political figures are demanding legal action against Husseini and Ashrawi. Foreign Minister David Levy noted today that Israel had allowed Palestinian representatives to come and go, but they must know the consequences if they took part in the conference in Algiers. Levy repeated that Israel has the right to refuse to negotiate with anyone it doesn't approve of. Shamir said it's clear that Husseini and Ashrawi would not represent anybody at the conference. For National Public Radio, this is Patricia Golan in Jerusalem.
The Dow Jones Industrials lost 11 points today to close at 3,006. This is NPR. Amnesty International said today that human rights abuses are still commonplace in Peru and that President Bush's statements to the contrary were misleading. During the visit of Peruvian President Alberto Fujimori earlier this month, President Bush said that the incidence of human rights abuses had fallen dramatically since Fujimori took office. Amnesty International said that it has documented many disappearances, killings, and cases of torture under the Fujimori administration. The Bush administration wants to give Peru $95 million in military anti-drug assistance. That aid is being blocked by a group of U.S. lawmakers because of human rights abuses. The Senate Judiciary Committee voted today to send the Supreme Court nomination of Judge Clarence Thomas to the Senate floor without a recommendation. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
All six Republicans on the committee and one Democrat, Dennis DeConcini of Arizona, voted to recommend Thomas's nomination favorably, but they were blocked by the seven other Democrats on the panel. The split gives opponents of the nominee a boost, but most still believe Thomas will be confirmed when his nomination goes to the full Senate. One strategy opponents could use is a filibuster, but no Democratic senator on the committee said he was willing to begin a filibuster. Thomas's most ardent opponent on the panel, Howard Metzenbaum of Ohio, said a filibuster would be unseemly. To be confirmed, Thomas needs just a simple majority of 51 senators, but to break a filibuster, 60 votes would be required. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
The Bush administration announced today that it's providing a $1 million grant to provide artificial limbs and rehabilitation services for war victims in Vietnam. It's the first direct aid to Vietnam since the end of the Southeast Asian War. The program will be carried out by a private volunteer organization that already provides prosthetic services in Vietnam. At least 4 million Vietnamese are said to have been maimed as a consequence of the war. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I want to thank Marty Moss Cohen for filling in for me these past few days while I visited a few of the West Coast stations which carry Fresh Air and had the chance to meet a lot of our listeners. Well, tomorrow begins a new season for Saturday Night Live, and it will be the second season since Nora Dunn left the program. As you may remember, she left after refusing to appear on the same show with comic Andrew Dice Clay. But she's kept alive some of the characters she created for Saturday Night Live, like model-turned-talk show host Pat Stevens, lounge singer Liz Sweeney of the Sweeney Sisters, and sex kitten Babette. She's written new material for them in her new book, Nobody's Rib, which is also the name of her one-woman show that she's touring the country with. She told me that Pat Stevens was based on an actual person.
She was patterned after a woman named Connie, who used to come to my high school and talk to us about an exciting career in makeup and modeling. And she was very disconnected to anything else, any other reality. And I went to a inner-city high school in Chicago and went through the tumultuous, you know, end of the 60s there, and we had a lot of racial problems and a lot of intensity. And in the midst of it all, the nuns would have Connie. And she'd talk like this. And she would just, you know, get up and say, you know, ask us questions and show us how to stand. Of course, you always said, you know, you stand with your, and sit with the knees in the locked position. So that's how she stemmed out of her. I used to call my friends on the phone as Connie, and they always bought it, you know. And they would somehow get, you know, finagled into coming down to the School of Beauty Culture and taking a tour.
Just come down Saturday. Let's just show you what we've got here to offer.
So she came out of that.
So how would you shop for Pat Stevens?
Well, I wouldn't shop for him. I mean, she does definitely does her own shopping. Loves to shop. In fact, when she writes these, there's some beat poems in the book, and Pat became just very briefly became a beat poet. She was in Chicago, and she was wanted to go to a zoo. And she mistakenly went to the Art Institute because there were two big lions on the outside. When she walked in here, she was in an art museum, and there was lots of course, big pictures, which she liked. And she runs into a poet there who talks her into going to a poetry slam, and she thinks she's going dancing. And she goes and hears poems, and then she begins writing her own poems and calls her psychiatrist later, and he tells her, well, you know, this is, you need to go shopping. So she goes and she buys the whole Shiseido line and gets herself back, never writes another poem again.
Do you want to do one of the poems for us?
Oh, yeah, I'd love to. Let me see. This one is called, I'll read it as Pat. Imelda, we hardly knew you. I remember how deeply she grieves from inside her puffy sleeves. Her eyes are puffy, too. Well, wouldn't you cry? I mean, why did they have to keep her shoes? That was wrong. They belonged to her. No wonder she sings the blues. At least she looks best in that color.
That's good. That's
and
very good.
The one I like a lot is, here's my favorite. This one is called,
Jackie is 60. I can't believe it. Jackie Onassis. Jackie, oh. Jackie Kennedy. Jackie rose up. Jackie, you rose up. You made your fortune. You found Maurice or he, you or you, he, whatever will be, will be. Jackie Jack. Jackie Shack. Jackie come back. Caroline, John, John, baby Rose, blow her nose. There she goes. She's walking now, Jackie. Oh, Jackie, you live in the now somehow. Art, culture, a beaded evening bag. Never an old bag or an old hag. Jackie will never let us down. I wish she could wear a crown on Martha's Vineyard or a pillbox hat. But what's not is not. I've said goodbye to Camelot. I won't cry. Don't die, Jackie. Oh, Jackie, don't die, please.
That's wonderful. That's a Pat Stevens performance poet.
Yeah. It struck me as very funny when I started writing. I could have written these things forever, these little Pat Beat poems. That was fun.
You used to write poetry yourself, didn't you?
I mean, did.
Real poems? Yeah.
Yeah, I did. In fact, you know, I write short stories. I wanted to put some in the book, but they weren't really quite appropriate. They're not as humorous as this. This is a book of humorous collections. But someday I really would love to get some of my stories published and some of the poetry published.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Nora Dunn, and she's written a book of basically her characters, and it's called Nobody's Rib. She's also doing a one-person show of the same name. Now, you also did a kind of lounge act on Saturday Night Live. Liz Sweeney of
the Sweeney Sisters.
Yeah. How does she sing?
I think very well. I'm kidding. I give myself a compliment. My sister and I played together for a long, long time. And we finally stopped. I went off on my own. I became a hostess. I work at the Ground Chuck restaurant. I love it. I'm a people person. But you know what I did? I couldn't stay away. I stopped doing medleys. And I have such a deep love and respect for medleys. But you can't sing them by yourself, can you? So I was at home one day, and I was singing in the mirror looking at myself. It was in the morning. I had a negligee, long kind of negligee on. And here I am singing. I was singing Born Free, I think. Or maybe it was something cabaret. And a mouse came in the room. And it just ran up my leg. And as I was singing it, you know, I felt that mouse come up. And I realized I was a scat singer. And it was all because that little mouse, you know, ran up my leg like that. And it's funny how, you know, a mouse can change your life. It's always a little tiny thing that you know, makes you go in another direction. So that's what I do. I scat. And it's hard because, you know, I've done a lot of my scatting in the farm belt. So I'm an unemployed scat singer. A lot of people come up and they say, you know, we love your singing, but we can't understand the words. So they really don't know what scat is, kind of across the whole heartland there. It's hard. It's a difficult. That's why I hostess at the Ground Chuck. I've got to have something to fall back on.
So Nora Dunn, who was the model for Liz Sweeney?
No one. No one at all. You know, some of the characters are just like that. Jan and I were doing a commercial parody for the show and started singing, and Phil was with us, and we started doing, like, bad musicals, and each of us would come up with kind of another song that was funny, and Jan and I kept it up with the medleys, and then she really wanted to do it, you know, and thought up the name Sweeney Sisters, and I don't know. I mean, it was just a feeling that I had.
It's amazing how the medley is such the perfect vehicle for schlocky songs.
Oh, yeah. You know, it's like Reader's Digest. just endless. I mean, that was the most fun I had, I think, on Saturday Night Live, was writing and performing the medleys. That was always, you really look forward to it. It was so much fun.
Did you ever include songs that you used to genuinely like when you were younger?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, we chose songs we loved and then destroyed them. I remember we did one with Mary Tyler Moore, and she sang, fish gotta swim, birds gotta fly, I gotta love one man till I die. I love that song. Of course, we have De Clang, Clang, Clang with the trolley. And we would take songs that should be funny. I remember on the Emmys, Jan sang, I've got a gorilla. For sale, Magilla Gorilla for sale. And I did Car 54, Where Are You? If it was a very deep, you know. Car 54, where are you? So there were those kind of songs that we were doing serious, and then we did stuff we really loved. And, you know, we're kind of closet singers. You know, I don't have a good enough voice to be a singer. So it was nice to sort of live that fantasy with the Sweeneys because they really believe that they are great. Totally. They totally believed it.
One more question about Liz Sweeney. When you started doing the Sweeney Sisters, did you end up going to hotel lounges a lot to hear who was performing?
Well, I love lounge acts, and I have seen a lot of them. And, you know, there's quite a few around New York, and I would do that. But I never specifically did it for the Sweeneys. I really wanted to take the Sweeneys on the road and do a tour of the Holiday Inns and just have them build as the Sweeney Sisters, not as us. I love that kind of thing.
You know, if I were a lounge singer, fat chance, and I saw you walk in, I'd say I'd be pretty self-conscious knowing what you were there for.
Yeah.
Did that ever happen?
No, it hasn't. Luckily, I don't think anyone's ever, like, recognized me. I was up in Seattle and saw this woman. She was great, but she had, instead of having a band, which I really miss now, people have all this electrical stuff, and she just played piano and then had the simulated computer band, you know. And she actually sang, God, what she sang, Me and Bobby McGee, and, some song she was, but she really, like, really got into it. And I felt bad. I didn't want her to think I was there to make fun of her. You know, and we end up really having a good time. I thought, God, the last thing in the world I wanted to do is think that I'm looking down my nose at her or something. But there is something humorous about it.
My guest is comedian Nora Dunn. She is a former cast member of Saturday Night Live. She's currently touring the country with her one-woman show called Nobody's Rib. It's also the title of her new book. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Actress and writer Nora Dunn is my guest. You left Saturday Night Live, and that coincided with your refusal to be on the same show as Andrew Dice Clay.
Mm-hmm.
Were you fired or did you quit?
No, I wasn't fired. You know, I came back the next week and did the show. My contract was up that year, which they did not renew my contract. I did not ask them to renew my contract. So it was a mutual separation. I was on the show for a long time, and it was ready, you know, I was ready not to be on the show, and I didn't want to leave on a controversial kind of a note. It just happened that way. But I really wasn't going to come back for a sixth year on the show.
Mm-hmm. Why did you decide to take the stand that you did when they booked Andrew Dice Clay to be the guest host?
Well, it was a surprise to me. I didn't know he was the guest host until Monday, and my husband knew and didn't tell me all weekend because he knew that I would be very upset. And I felt really hurt by it. That was my first reaction, is why would they have him on the show? I know he's got a movie coming out and so forth, but... And it's not because he's controversial, and it's not because he says bad words on the stage. It's definitely the content of the material and the hatefulness of it and the anti-humanistic quality of that kind of comedy. I think it's such a fascist tone to it, and it just goes against every shred of feeling of integrity that I have about my own work. And I had struggled on the show somewhat. A lot of sketches I didn't want to do, and the writers knew that there was a lot of stuff that I thought was in bad taste. They went ahead and did it. That was the nature of the show. There was everybody writing all nature of material. So and sometimes I think I was possibly too cautious in what I wanted to be identified with when it comes to humor and comedy. But this was something that I knew I wouldn't be able to write a satirical sketch that was hard-hitting enough to say what I had to say, and certainly there's no guarantee that it would have been on the air. And I really couldn't face the idea of going out for good nights and standing up there with a big smile on my face and waving to the audience when I would have felt that what we did was a betrayal to the quality and the integrity of all the seasons of Saturday Night Live. You know, everything that show stood for me from the very beginning.
Had you seen Andrew Dice Clay's work?
I had seen parts of his HBO special, and I went out and got a CD that day, Monday, because I thought, well, I better really listen to his latest piece and see maybe this is sort of grounded in some kind of an anger, or maybe it's just black comedy, and maybe I'm not getting it. So I bought his latest, and it was just hate humor.
I'm glad you said that you actually went out and listened to it to decide what you really thought of it, as opposed to just operating by what you thought he was probably doing as opposed to what he was really doing.
Yeah.
Because sometimes, you know, we have expectations that are wrong. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So. And sometimes you misinterpret what someone's doing.
Yeah, right. Right.
And I also felt that there was all of that time for him to explain it in any kind of a satirical context. Mm-hmm. And it's clear that he doesn't. It's clear that it doesn't come from any source of intelligence, and it's very exploitive. It exploits people's fears, and comedies ought to, you know, release that.
So did you get any support from the other performers on the show?
I don't think they were indifferent about it. They didn't quite know what to do. And I also was under a different contract. Then the cast came a year later than me. They had another year, and I think they felt that they had to play it safer than I felt I did. Which is not to say if I had another year, it would have been any different, because I tend to fly off the handle on these kinds of things. I'm not calm about it. But I think for them, they felt a little frightened, and no one that I work with on the cast is that kind of a person. None of them were really very confrontational. Very creative, very, very funny group. But I wouldn't think it would be characteristic for them to have done that kind of thing.
You said that there had been a lot of sketches that you really didn't want to participate in because you thought they were in bad taste. What kinds of sketches?
Well, some of them I just was uncomfortable with their real insensitivity to women. I really got tired of whores, and I didn't want to play them. And it's not because I'm just tired of it. It's a tedious characterization, and there was just too much of it. And there seemed to be only two characters that these guys could write, and one was the kind of a promiscuous, hoary type of girl, and the other was a housewife who may as well have had a lobotomy. Almost every housewife I played, or mother, you know, had about two lines and kind of sat with her head bobbing. And when Jan and I did stuff together, it was always very, the characters had integrity. The Sweeney sisters really, they believed in themselves. We weren't making them losers or making fun of them as losers. They were real successful in their eyes. Same thing with Pat Stevens. You know, I had to struggle a lot not to have the legs pulled out from underneath her as to actually what she is about. And it was, you know, you kind of had to beat them off your work so much. To just get them to say, no, it's not girl humor, it's just humor. And so often we heard, well, I don't get girl humor. All right, we're going to do a woman sketch this week. So it was always kind of boxed off in the corner here. You kind of feel like women and children over here and men over here. And I just got tired of it. And there were quite a few pieces like that that were just, I just felt they were old. I just felt they just weren't... Now, they might have been appropriate 15 years ago, but they're just not appropriate now.
What's the difference between the whorish kinds of roles you didn't want to play in sketches and the Babette the Sex Kitten role you came up with for yourself?
Well, Babette is, she's a sex kitten because a sex kitten never dies, we just get fluffy. The intent of Babette is that her idea of a strong woman is very distorted. She's proud of her film. She did a portrait of woman. You know, woman came from the French made woman because we took the tiny word men, which is an American word, and we put the French word woo in front of it. So that is how we get woman. But I am a strong, fluffy sex kitten. I did film always for a strong woman role, and that's why I made... I was a firefighter in female firefighter Centerfold USA. I was in all this film. I made
a portrait series for television, and it was to cover women in all walk of life. I made portrait of an escort, portrait of a showgirl, portrait of a naked slut on drugs, portrait of a female cop on crack. I also played a woman who was so angry, she's pursuing a serial killer rapist, and she kills him while he is being electrocuted in the electric chair.
So she's all these roles that she's played that are her. She thinks that is strong.
Even I was in Gunload, and they play an aerobic instructor who is so strong that she's working out of the stairmaster. And the criminal comes into the room, blows off of her head with an AK-47, but she still continues to work out without her head. And finishes her workout 45 minutes, and then she dies, only after the workout.
So that's her point. It's not, there's something else there.
I really love what you're getting at with the character, which is someone who manages to turn all these kind of sexist stereotypes of women into strength. Mm-hmm. Look how strong I am.
Yeah.
Before you got into comedy, you were a writer, you were a painter, you went to art school, and then it was after that that you went to San Francisco and took some acting lessons, mm-hmm. and then started performing at comedy clubs. What led you to try comedy?
Well, I studied acting for a couple of years, and I had these characters that I did on my own, and a friend of mine that I met in acting class was a comedian, and he said, you know, you should just do some of these characters on stage or do them for a monologue. And so I started doing my characters on the stage, and it just sort of, it was one of those things that once I started doing it, even though I was absolutely terrified, it was terrifying, when it worked, the feeling was great. So I just kept writing them.
What was the worst humiliation that you faced on stage?
Oh, God, there's so many. But I remember one night these people came up from Los Angeles, and there was always somebody coming up to see, and I got to be part of 10 comics, but I went on last. By the time I went on, the whole audience had left, and it was just these judges, you know. And I had, at the time I used to wear things, I had a wig on, and I was in this whole character, and I got up and did it, and I did not know how to get off the stage, and I just eventually just kind of stopped, and I wanted to get down and just slither off like a snake, but I didn't even have the courage to do that. I just sort of wandered off the stage, and it was Kevin Meaney who was there and was so nice to me, because most comics would just, you know, run as you came if you failed, and he came up and said, "That must have been just terrible for you."
Oh, that's really encouraging.
And I said, "Thank you." Oh no, it made me feel great because it was terrible, and I wanted so much just for someone to go, "God, you know, let's go have a drink."
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "That wasn't your fault." Another time, I was in Chicago with Christine Zander, who's a writer on Saturday Night Live, and we performed together. And we did a show at this theater, and my mom and dad were in town, and they came to the show, and there was only two other people in the audience.
Oh, God.
And we did the show, and it was a total failure. And I remember my father coming up after the show, and he said, "You know, I don't think it was you. I really think it was the audience." But those things you wear like badges. All the failures are what you learn by, and then the triumphs are just feel good.
Mm. Well, Nora Dunn's new book and her one-person show is called Nobody's Rib. And Nora Dunn, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us. It was really a lot
You're
of fun
welcome.
To have
My
you on
pleasure.
The show. And I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. As a syndicated political cartoonist, Jeff Danziger has defined the humor in very serious situations. Now he's branched out into fiction, and his first novel is a dark comedy about the Vietnam War. Coming up, we meet Jeff Danziger. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from Italian drummer Aldo Romano. It's a tribute to Ornette Coleman. Kevin says it's also a good introduction to the Italian jazz scene. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Rambling Rose, starring Robert Duvall and Laura Dern. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. A State Department official says that Iraqi officials have agreed to end a standoff in downtown Baghdad involving a UN inspection team. The U.S. official says under this agreement, the team will be allowed to leave a parking lot where it has been detained for the last 4 days and keep documents tied to Iraq's nuclear weapons program. Under this agreement, Iraq would get an inventory of the various documents. In Moscow, Soviet leader Gorbachev has indicated concern about continuing unrest in the Republic of Georgia. At least 4 people have been killed this week. Robert Parsons of the BBC reports that the violence is the worst in the Soviet Republic in recent months.
After a night of tension and violence, everything appeared calm in the Georgian capital today. Looking out from Tatsminda, the mountain that overlooks this beautiful city, Tbilisi appears a haven of peace. The autumn sunshine is warm, and there is a constant hum from the heavy traffic in the streets below. Yet at the parliament and the television center, the struggle for power in Georgia is rapidly reaching a climax. Last night, there was no attempt to storm the opposition strongholds at the television center, but the government kept up the psychological pressure by switching off the electricity supply and spreading rumors that the opposition forces were surrounded. Its policy appears to be to wear down the guards, but as yet there is little sign that they are ready to surrender.
Robert Parsons of the BBC. On Capitol Hill, House and Senate negotiators have produced a compromise bill to grant extra benefits to some 3 million unemployed Americans. The measure will most likely be approved by Congress next week and sent on to the president, who is expected to veto. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold has more.
The Senate began debate on the compromise today. It would provide up to 20 weeks of additional unemployment benefits to states hit hardest by the recession. Supporters were armed with newly released figures today showing a weakening economy and a rise in the number of those claiming jobless benefits. In addition, the Census Bureau reported 2.1 million more Americans were living in poverty in 1990 than the previous year. Texas Democrat Lloyd Benson says the president is wrong to think the bill is unnecessary because the recession is ending.
I hope with these new numbers and more concern that the president will change his mind, recognize the tragedy of hundreds of thousands of Americans who have exhausted their benefits, and join Congress in an effort to respond to this crisis.
Democrats hope to override the president's expected veto of the bill. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 11 points to close at 3,006.04 on volume of 160 million shares. This is NPR News. On Capitol Hill, the Senate Judiciary Committee today split 7-7 on the U.S. Supreme Court nomination of Judge Clarence Thomas. That nomination now goes on to the full Senate, where no vote is possible before next Thursday, giving both sides time to try and gain support for their arguments. Also in Washington, the government today signed an agreement providing the first official U.S. assistance to Vietnam since the Vietnam War ended. NPR's Paz Cohen has more on the story.
The money, $1.3 million, will be given by the U.S. Agency for International Development to 2 U.S.-based organizations that will use it to provide physical therapy and artificial limbs to war victims in Vietnam. Dr. Richard Bissell is Assistant Administrator of USAID.
This is a relatively modest amount of money, but it should not detract from the importance of the United States' decision to provide this assistance. Even after 16 years, the Vietnam War still provokes many feelings among Americans. but on this occasion, what brings us together is concern for the people of Vietnam and the opportunity to broaden the normalization of relations with that country.
The U.S. and Vietnam agreed in late 1987 to cooperate on humanitarian concerns. A State Department official cautioned that today's grant does not mean the two countries are normalizing relations. I'm Pas Cohen reporting.
Soviet President Gorbachev says that the various Soviet republics are close to signing a new economic agreement in an effort to save the nation from financial collapse. This agreement is aimed at including, in some form, all 15 Soviet republics. Since last month's failed coup, the three Baltic states have broken with Moscow, and nine other republics have formally declared their independence. The Soviet president says that he is hopeful the official signing will take place during the first 10 days of October. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Recently, a number of jazz musicians have dedicated albums to the works of a single composer, like Duke Ellington, Thelonious Monk, and Bill Evans. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has this review of a new release by drummer Aldo Romano, devoted to the compositions of Ornette Coleman, one of the founders of the free jazz movement. First, here's a little of Coleman's WRU, played by the composer.
Ornette Coleman shook up the jazz world 30 years ago by adopting an elastic approach to form. When Coleman took a solo, he might stretch 12 bars worth of material out to 13 and a half bars, or wander from one key into another. Those tactics struck some folks as radically modern, but they weren't much different from what some country blues players had been doing. These days, now that the controversy surrounding Coleman has died down some, a lot of musicians have come to realize what a great composer he is. A couple of albums over the last couple of years showcase Ornette's compositions with very different results. On John Zorn's 1989 album, Spy vs. Spy, the thrashing arrangements tried to recreate the shock value Coleman's music had when it first came along. Released by drummer Aldo Romano, called To Be or Net To Be, takes the opposite approach. Instead of reminding us how disturbing Coleman's music once seemed, Romano calls attention to the lyricism and springy rhythm it had all along. Aldo Romano comes from Italy, which has one of the richest and most interesting jazz scenes in Europe, something few Americans know about because Italian jazz records are hard to come by in the States. Even avid American jazz fans would have trouble naming a handful of Italian improvisers. But Romano records for the French label Owl, which does have good distribution here, and his Ornette album is a good introduction to some leading Italian players. On trumpet is Paolo Fresu, one musician who has a shot at becoming better known in the States because he fits the modern profile for jazz success. Fresu is in his 20s, and the records he makes under his own name sound like the mainstream jazz of the 1960s. If he lived over here, he'd probably be recording for RCA, and you'd have read about him in Time magazine by now. Thank you. lot of this album's appeal is due to Paulo Freire's lyrical trumpet style and the pleasing vocalized sound he gets using a Harmon mute. Lyricism and a singing instrumental tone are two hallmarks of Italian jazz, which makes sense given Italy's rich vocal traditions. The pianist in Aldo Romano's quartet is Franco D'Andrea. Like the leader, he's a veteran jazz man who deserves to be better known. D'Andrea really catches the open spirit of Ornette Coleman's music. Aldo Romano's quartet comes closer to the flexibility of Ornette Coleman's improvising style than most modern jazz groups, including other groups who play Ornette's music. Coleman may have taken jazz the next logical step 30 years ago, but few musicians have been willing or able to follow. The quality of Aldo Romano's album suggests that the way to learn to play like Ornette is to pay close attention to his compositions. If you understand how a jazz musician writes, you'll know a lot about the way he improvises.
Kevin Whitehead is a freelance writer based in New York City. He reviewed To Be or Net to Be on the Owl label. This is Fresh Air. Jeff Danziger spends his time finding the humor in news stories like the nomination of Clarence Thomas to the Supreme Court, conflicts over Israeli loan guarantees, and unemployment in America. Danziger is a political cartoonist with the Christian Science Monitor. His cartoons are syndicated by the Los Angeles Times. Apparently, Danziger is one of those cartoonists who's had a novel in progress stashed in his drawer for many years, but unlike many such would-be novelists, he's finished his. It's called Rising Like the Tucson, and it's based on his tour of duty in Vietnam. From 1970 to 71, he was an intelligence officer with the 1st Air Cavalry Division. His novel is about the absurd aspects of the war. The main character is an intelligence officer who gets letters from his dad suggesting he invest in real estate in Vietnam because, after all, there's no opportunity like being in a war zone after the war is won.
After Richard Nixon was elected and announced that there were going to be, he had a secret plan to end the war. In Paris, the peace talks were going on. And it looked like the war was going to come to an end similar to what was going on and what had happened in Korea. And this main character's father is a developer in Connecticut, and he wants to have his son get into on the ground floor to buy land in Vietnam while the prices are low. Because after the settlement, the prices are going to go through the roof. And it was true that in Vietnam at that time, in fact, companies were setting up shop. Most of the companies were construction companies, but the Japanese were building factories along the main route from Benoit to Saigon. People were buying land. The French were still there. And one of the telling things when you got off the plane, if you were in the army and you got off the plane at Tansanut Air Base, when you first arrived in the country, the first sign you saw was a huge billboard that said, "You have a friend at the Chase Manhattan."
Do you want to read one of the father's letters to the son?
All right, he writes, "Remember, son, there is no time in history like the time right after a war when you're on the winning side. It's the time when the victors make the laws and take what they like. What fools we were in Japan. Why did we not just annex the whole damn country? Why didn't we treat them like the little rats they were? We would now own the entire island of Japan, an entire colony of hard-working little Japs all making things for us. American boys died in the Pacific so their sons could pay money for Japanese cars. I tell you, son, when I think of it, it makes me so damn mad. We won the war. The entire place should have belonged to us.
The humor in your novel could be described as black humor. Was your sense of humor shaped at all by the war?
I think it was certainly shaped by novels like Catch 22, which is the classic of the Second World War, and that in the middle of the violent desperation of war, there is a great deal of farce going on. And in some cases, the worse things get, the more you need to look around for something to balance it.
Give me a sense of something that happened to you in real life during the war that was absolutely farcical.
You know, most of the things which happened in this book, which the incidents in the book actually did happen, there's the part where the infantry platoons, because there's the accusation that they're faking the numbers of North Vietnamese that they've killed, are given Polaroid cameras to take a picture of each dead North Vietnamese. Well, that's in the book as an incident, but it actually did happen. And since there wasn't any limit on the amount of Polaroid film, some of the platoon leaders would take 3, 4, and 5 pictures of a dead North Vietnamese soldier. And then when they got back to the base or the officers' club, they would trade them back and forth like
baseball cards,
you know. And this actually did happen. I witnessed it myself.
Now, how did you were in the war in 70, 71, is that right?
Yeah.
How did you get into cartooning after that?
I moved back. I was in Vermont, and I just was teaching school. And I began sending drawings into a paper in Montpelier, Vermont, the Times Argus, and they started printing them and paying me $1 a piece.
Hey.
I knew this
Hope
was...
Hope you didn't spend it all in one place.
I knew this was what I wanted to do.
Get-rich-quick scheme. You cartoon now for the Christian Science Monitor. Are there any restrictions against doing cartoons about medical issues?
No, the Monitor is owned by the Christian Science Church, but it remains fairly secular in its editorial views, and they comment on just about anything that comes along that's a legitimate news issue.
You had in a cartoon recently about Shamir Bush and the loan guarantees.
Mm-hmm.
And this is probably a very controversial cartoon for you. Would you describe it and tell us the response that you got?
Well, this was Shamir with a machine gun trying to get approval for the loan guarantees. And the ammunition for the machine gun, which he's holding on Baker and Bush, is a box of shells called Influence in Congress. And I think it occurred to a lot of people that the way there was almost an implied threat that Israel had sufficient friends in Congress to get the loan guarantee, whether or not George Bush was in favor of it. That's what that was trying to show.
The response you got?
Well, the response was vociferous, but people who do call up, I talk with them. If they want to talk to me on the phone, they go ahead and do it. And usually the result is that we agree to disagree, and I respect their point of view. And certainly in some cases, if I'm wrong, I just apologize.
Do you ever do a change of heart cartoon or a fairness cartoon if you feel that you've represented one side and people are demanding that you represent the other? Or is cartooning just not objective and that's the breaks?
Well, the purpose of the cartoon is to get some
point of view,
modicum of humor. That's uh-huh. right, and used to do it through humor. It's an unfair form of criticism because if you don't like what someone did in a cartoon, it's not like a column. You can't sit down and refute it point by point. It's simply either ridicule or laughter. And so, if someone has a very good point about something, I normally just either apologize or try to do something in mitigation if I think I'm wrong.
How does your drawing style and your cartoons compare to the kind of style that you had when you were studying art in college?
Well, I have to tell you, I never did.
Oh,
I never
thought
you did study art. No, I have taken courses in anatomy. The two big problems in cartooning are that when you sit down to do an editorial cartoon and there is nothing in front of you to draw, you may have a photograph of Bush or Baker or Shamir or something to use as a caricature, but the remainder of the furniture, the setting, the airplane, whatever they happen to be in, is very largely imaginary. So cartoonists have to make it up pretty much out of their memory. And the two big problems are anatomy, which you have to memorize because it's not there to watch, and perspective and background work.
So what do you have on the drawing board now? You're away from home today. You're visiting Philadelphia.
Well, we have a tendency to go for the Monitor being an international paper, we tend to look at international issues as much or maybe more than we do with the domestic issues. And though that's not always the case. So I've been doing things on the emerging story in China and the prisoners who are being used in factories in China, and a situation that results from the breakup of the Soviet Union, numerous potential wars that we're going to have to deal with.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much.
Jeff Danziger is a syndicated political cartoonist and author of the new novel Rising Like the Tucson. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, how are you covering the tie vote in the Judiciary Committee on the Clarence Thomas nomination?
Now, we'll be hearing from Nina Totenberg about the themes stressed by the members of the Judiciary Committee as they explain their votes today. It's a tie vote, but the committee voted at the same time to report the nomination to the Senate floor without any recommendation. So there will be, unless something unforeseen happens, a debate and a vote on the Senate floor on the Thomas nomination. Also, our fifth report by Patricia Naiman on Teresa Perez, the recovering crack addict whose progress we've been following for the past several months.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In the 70s, director Martha Coolidge was a rising star of the independent documentary movement. But in the 80s, she went Hollywood. Her 1983 teen picture, Valley Girl, won some attention, but her next film, The Joy of Sex, went virtually unreleased. And movies like Real Genius and Plain Clothes never managed to restore her reputation. Film critic Stephen Schiff says her new movie, Rambling Rose, should change all that.
Well, you may not think so at first. Rambling Rose starts off in the snoozy, terminally virtuous style of an American Playhouse production. We're in the South in 1971, and a middle-aged man named Buddy, played by John Hurd, is reminiscing about his Georgia childhood in a cornpone accent too soggy to swallow. What he's remembering, though, is the year 1935, when he was 13, and a gawky young woman named Rose arrived to live with his family and do some housework. Rose is an orphan and an incest victim to boot. And Buddy's family takes her in out of the goodness of their hearts. If 1,000 movies about ingrown Southern dementia have made us expect a gothic horror show, Rambling Rose gives us something even more intriguing. A deeply felt portrait of a family that, for once, is not in the least dysfunctional. But this isn't some bland Cracker Barrel Ozzie and Harriet, either. The screenwriter, Calder Willingham, has adapted his own breezy autobiographical novel, and he's given his characters detailed, wonderfully observed voices and personalities. Mother Hillier, played by Diane Ladd, is hard of hearing and a little too well-educated for her own good, and Father Hillier, played by Robert Duvall, can be stubborn and short-sighted. Their virtue is plainly hard-won, and that makes it all the more poignant. But with the arrival of Rose, played by Laura Dern, that virtue is tested as never before, because, as it turns out, Rose is a sweet, not terribly bright, nymphomaniac. At first, her carnal appetite is directed at Duval's Papa Hillier, who, to our surprise, fends her off, not without a certain amount of inner struggle. So Rose decides to vent her charms on the rest of the town, and soon her coltish sexuality, and the skimpy dresses she garbs it in, get more results than anyone bargained for. As witness this scene, when Mr. Hillier storms into Rose's bedroom to find that her latest swain, Billy, has leaped out the second-story window.
I'm afraid that your friend Billy is injured now. Where are his clothes?
Under the mattress.
I didn't want you to be mad. He wants to marry me, Mister. He's really a sweet boy. I can't marry him. I mean, you know, he ain't got no money and got no job. He's too young and all, but... Well, he loves me, and... Well, I was just thinking maybe that you wouldn't want to hurt him or anything.
No, I won't hurt him, Rose.
Mr. Hillier, I know I was bad, and I hadn't ought to have done it. But I am only a human girl person, and I ain't always perfect.
Laura Dern is the most unspectacular-looking sex object in recent movies, a plain girl whose genuine erotic heat comes not from slithering and shimmying, but from the almost childish excitement she projects over being a woman, over inhabiting the body she inhabits. Rose is her finest, most complex performance to date, and she seems to lift everyone up along with her. Robert Duvall hasn't been this radiant and full of life in years, and Diane Ladd, Dern's off-screen mother, seems to have given up her inveterate scenery-chewing. She has an unaccustomed gravity and warmth. Even Lucas Haas, as young Buddy, makes something fresh out of the usual precocious kid coming-of-age role. Director Martha Coolidge coaxes her actors to underplay and let Willingham's amusingly baroque dialogue pound his points home. Most of those points are about the naturalness of Rose's rampant sexuality, about how it's just an outgrowth of her search for love and her pulsing, bubbling life force, all of which any habitual moviegoer has heard a million times before, but not like this. Rambling Rose is about rather ordinary people and rather ordinary truths. It's the way this movie unveils them that makes them feel brand new.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. He reviewed Rambling Rose. If you have any comments you want to pass on to us about Fresh Air, call our toll-free listener response line at 1-800-NPR-WHYY. Fresh Air was produced today by Fred Landerl, Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Joan Tui, and Sue Spolin. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester, and it's performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
5 years ago, writer Andre Debuse was helping the victims of an auto accident when he was struck by a car. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about how the accident, which crippled him, changed his life and his writing. Also, a talk with jazz French hornist Willie Ruff. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.